our enemies that need to be smashed really do need to be smashed. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Bible Geeks Podcast. This is episode 6. I'm Brian Sheely.
I'm Ryan Joy.
And thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. Let's get started here, and we're going to talk about the progress that we made from the last challenge. The last challenge was all about setting up a regular interval to sing. How'd you do with that, Ryan?
I had a lot of fun with it. That book, I know you texted me when you got that metrical Psalms book, I think, in the mail, and,
yes,
and said that you thought it was pretty cool. I'm interested in how you're using that, because I have really had fun, not only with that book, but just with, I've been all over YouTube finding different versions of some of the different Psalms and just singing through the Psalms. What are you doing with that?
I got that book, and man, it's awesome. I love it. I think it's like, specifically, I like how they suggest a few different tunes that you can use to sing each of the Psalms with, so you're not locked in.
Yeah.
And how they talk about the metering, so that if you have other songs that you know that has that same meter, you can also use those. Here at Monte Vista, we use a hymnal called Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs. And actually, the majority of the hymns all have the metering defined in it. So you can look up, you can cross-reference between these two books and find other hymns that you know the tune to, and then use those, which is really cool. So, yeah, I've enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I've been identifying, I just, in my little Kindle book, I have highlighted which of the tunes, which of the hymn melodies I am going to sing this song to. I know they encourage you to do it a bunch of different ways, but I want these things to stick in my head with a particular melody. And so I'm just identifying ones that go with it. But it's really actually been a good thing that I don't know a lot of these hymns, because then whenever I listen to them and I learn the melodies, now I associate these words with that. And so I try to sing them over and over again, and I'm not trying to rush through the book, but I keep, you know, I'm trying to get them ingrained in me so that, you know, like if you were Peter or Paul, who was used to singing these hymns in the synagogue,
yeah,
it's like some of the Psalms that we know, you just have these Psalms in your mind associated with a melody, and you can just sing them wherever you go. And, you know, song lyrics just stick with you. And I could tell you all the lyrics to Thriller or something. I can't always tell you a whole Psalm, but the more I sing them, the more they get ingrained in me. So that's been fun.
It is really interesting, just the stark contrast between the language of these Psalms and the hymns that we typically sing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finding myself singing a song about how the Lord will destroy those who are unfaithful. And it's like, I don't think I've ever sung a hymn that actually has those words in it.
Yeah.
Not normally themes that we typically sing, but interesting anyway.
I think we're going to get into that in our Poetry in Motion today, this idea that we sometimes miss a whole aspect of the Bible because we're uncomfortable with that. But the New Testament picks it up, but it picks it up in a different way than we might think of it when we just look back at smashing our enemies that need to be smashed really do need to be smashed.
Yeah.
And there's a different set of enemies.
Let's dive right in here off the bat and talk about something that Jesus said.
So this is two words that Jesus said.
Oh, great.
I'm just going to read this verse, Mark chapter 2 and verse 14. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. What do you think?
Oh, man. There's so much to unpack here. Just two small words. But
yeah, and two words.
And it's like, I can't imagine being Levi, this commitment that he has to have, or just maybe a level of intrigue about Jesus. And you have to wonder if he knew about Jesus, he had heard about him before, if there was any backstory there for him. But the Gospel of Mark really doesn't describe a whole lot about the backstory of Levi and what he must have seen or what he must have known. if he had heard about this man, Jesus, before, but his level of commitment is remarkable here, just that he's willing to get up from his position as a tax collector and leave and go follow Jesus. But on the other side of it, I think Jesus's words specifically, he doesn't leave any room for interpretation. He doesn't leave him an out. He doesn't try to convince him or persuade him or anything like that. It's just a matter of fact that this is what you need to do. So get up and do it. And commendable to Levi that he actually does. So.
This happens over and over again with all the different disciples, of course, and we see this a lot, but these words, follow me, that is the simplest, I don't know whether to call it an invitation or a command or an exhortation, but it's the simplest essence of what it means to be a disciple. Follow me.
I kind of feel like we use that phrase invitation, like at the end of a sermon, we might invite someone to come to Jesus. In all the ways that Jesus calls his disciples to follow him, there's very little room for a denial. There's very little room for them to say no. And so in a different way than like, I might invite you over to my home, you could say no, you know, there'd be every reason for you to say no. I don't have any authority to command you to come to my home. But in a very different way, Jesus, I think he's doing much more than just inviting as a, well, you have the option to say no. It's definitely a command. There's no other alternative. I mean, there is an alternative to say no, but like there's no other viable alternative. He has to follow him. And so it is definitely something that the king is saying. I have authority here and you know that I have authority. And so you're going to do what I said.
Yeah. Even the phrases we think of as invitations, like come to me, all you who labor, you know, all who are heavy laden, that it's not, if you feel like it would be a good idea for you, or
if you're not,
you
know, busy,
like you say about an invitation, hey, are you available to come to me? It is imperative. It is in the form of a direction, a command,
right?
Come to me. It makes me think of how, you know, how your doctor gives you instructions, you know, take these pills and you will live.
If it's convenient for you, maybe you should take these pills.
Yeah. Think about around the time you get up, maybe. Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
If you want to, if you need something in order to be whole and healthy, the doctor has a job to tell you with some authority, here's what you have to do. And so even when Jesus says, come, when he says, follow me, there's authority because there is no other way. You can choose,
but
there is no other way. This is the only way to life.
You know, what comes first, faith or obedience? And here, there's no reason necessarily to think that Levi had all the evidence to back up his decision about Jesus being the Christ. It doesn't seem on the surface here that he had just some great faith based on a lot of backstory and a lot of reasoning, but his obedience is the thing that needed to happen first. And then obviously from there, his faith was going to grow. So sometimes I think we have this mentality that I need to have all the evidence, I need to have all the facts before I can commit myself. And with his example, I don't believe he did have all the facts. I don't believe he had a firmly established faith or belief in Jesus, but his obedience was the start. And then that leads him to have the opportunity to let his faith grow. Like sometimes you have to take the first step and then your faith can grow rather than the opposite way.
At a certain level, that's what faith is.
True.
It's a decision. Not that there's no evidence or there's no rational thinking, but you cannot be overwhelmingly convinced to where there's no denying what will happen. Faith is choosing to trust and be loyal. And it makes me think of John 7 and verse 17. I often want to figure out what something means. Do I understand it? Do I know it? Am I convinced? And then do it. But Jesus says there, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority.
Yeah.
you know, if you are already committed to do God's will, then you'll know what you need to know about what to do and what's true. But if you're trying to decide whether to do God's will, you won't know. And so there's this step before the step of, I'm already leaning in and now I can understand. And so I think that's kind of what Levi does here, is he takes the step that will lead him to deeper understanding over time. But it doesn't start with understanding everything. It starts with that first step of faith.
It's amazing that there are so many words to say in response to Jesus's two words, follow me.
Two words.
All right, so let's continue on. We're going to talk about Psalm 2 in our next segment, Poetry in Motion. We're picking up from Psalm 1, and I think the great thing about the Psalms, obviously there's so many Psalms, and as we mentioned in the episode where we talked about Psalm 1, Psalm 1 is the overall purpose of the entire collection of the Psalms. And then Psalm 2, we get into really, it's a summary, I think, of the overall message of the rest of the Psalm.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. It's so these two Psalms, they are set apart really from the whole book as an introduction. And if Psalm 1 is the purpose, Psalm 2 is the theme. And the theme, I might state it as, our God reigns. And we're going to see that he reigns in a very specific way. He reigns through someone. But it starts out with really all the evidence to the contrary that he doesn't really reign. And you look around, and if you open up your iPhone news app, you're going to find all kinds of things that start to look like God does not reign in the world. Mm-hmm. And this psalm starts with that idea, really asking the question, why do the nations rage? When it's hardest to see that God is reigning, that's when we need Psalm 2 the most. Mm-hmm. And so we see in Acts chapter 4, this picture of the first real persecution that the church undergoes. And Peter and John are brought before the Sanhedrin, and they're chastised and told not to speak in this name. And they're being opposed by the powers. And they've already seen their king, the anointed one, the Messiah, killed by the rulers and kings. And this passage seems to be pulled up into their minds, with the king being Herod and the ruler being Pilate. And those rulers have opposed God's anointed. And they say, we know that you're still in control, God. And they pray to God, they pray this psalm, and the room shakes. And that's when we need it, is when things look dark. We pray this psalm and realize that our God reigns. So let's read the first three verses. So it starts out, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.
It feels like you could pull that right out into today.
Yeah, it looks like the whole world is out of order, you know, like a soda machine that should have the piece of paper scotch tape to it that says, out of order, this is not working anymore. Yeah. You know, everything is chaotic, and the rulers who should be bringing justice, and we see this all over our world, are the ones who seem the most crazy and turbulent. I used to sometimes go out in a motorboat with my brother-in-law, and we would watch the way that right after the boat goes through, it just, the sea gets so choppy, and then if you come back around over top of it, it was fun, but you're bouncing like crazy on top of these crazy waves that you've just stirred up. And that's what the nations look like. And in the book of Revelation and some of the apocalyptic prophets of the Old Testament, you start to see this metaphor of the waters as the nations, because that's the kind of sea, this crazy chaos is what the world looks like. And yet we affirm that God reigns. And in fact, the people are plotting, and that's that word for meditate. Remember, we talked about it's like murmuring or muttering to yourself, only now they're not murmuring the word of God. These people are muttering against God and his anointed. Mm-hmm. But God has appointed a ruler. The Hebrew word for anointed one is Messiah. Mm. And the Greek word for anointed one is Christos, Christ. And so what we're talking about is the one who, whenever oil was poured on his head, God made a special appointment to him and poured out the Holy Spirit into them to do this task in 1 Samuel 16:13, right after Samuel anoints David with oil, it says that the Holy Spirit was given to him. And the same thing is talked about in Luke 4:18 and Acts 10:38 of Jesus, that he was anointed with the Holy Spirit whenever he was chosen as Messiah. So he's empowered by God to rule, and yet people aren't following. And so we see this picture of all of the world opposing the chosen king of God through whom he wants to reign.
And if this was where the psalm stopped, it would seem like a pretty depressing situation.
Yeah.
But behind the scenes, continuing on in Psalm 2, verses 4 through 6, it says, "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, 'As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill.'" And so we transition from the nations who are plotting and scheming against the Lord, who reject the Lord, back to God. I love the language here. Just the fact that he who sits in the heavens laughs. Just from the perspective of God, these little nations, these little people, they're down there doing all the things that they're doing, and God is just laughing. And then it transitions from his laughter to his anger, where it says, "Then he will speak to them in his wrath." He's not going to let this go. And it just highlights again how much the wisdom of God is higher than man. And God is there behind the scenes watching all of this. He knows what his plans are. He knows what he's going to do. And it reminds me of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 25, where Paul says, "For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." So for as wise as we think we are, for as much as we think we know, as strong as we think we are, God just looks at that and laughs. It's an awesome picture, I think, of how God is and how little he is influenced by even the greatest influence that we might think we have, especially in these nations and these rulers as they try to pull apart or pick apart the plans of God. And God will not have that. And so he then turns in his terror and his fury, and he says, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." And ultimately, this is a reference to Jesus. This is a reference to the ultimate king who was promised, the anointed one, the Christ, the Messiah, Jesus. And in Jesus here, all the way back in the Psalms, was the whole plan all along to take care of the problem of sin and to take care of the rejection of these nations of God. Jesus was going to be the one who reigned, who was in authority, and no one would be able to stop that from happening.
What a picture. God has chosen someone.
Yes.
To be king. I put him here. He's the rightful king. And then the king says, "I will tell of the decree." I'm going to tell you what the Lord said to me. "I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel.'" So this statement, "You are my son," is quoted quite a bit in the New Testament, but you can see how it goes back to what it means to be God's appointed king. And he says there in 2 Samuel 7:14, "I'll be his father and he'll be my son." That is the descendants, the king that comes from you, I'm going to adopt him. I'm going to make him my son. And so this term son of God and son of David are related all the way back to 2 Samuel 7 and Psalm 2. And this theme that God's son would be the king had an initial meaning of God choosing and taking into his family in a special relationship. And then in Hebrews compares it to the angels, says, which of the angels did he ever say, you are my son, today I've begotten you? And in Acts 13 and verse 33, this is connected to the resurrection. When was Jesus begotten? What day was he begotten and declared to be the Son of God? Well, Acts 13 and verse 33 says that in the resurrection, he was begotten as a son. That is, he was declared throughout the whole world to be the son who will reign forever on the throne. And this idea of the ends of the earth goes on from that. And that starts to involve us in this greater messianic kingdom, because what do we find at the end of the book of Matthew and the beginning of the book of Acts? For us, we find a command first given to the disciples and then to all those that they would teach to go to the ends of the earth, bringing the news of the reign of this king. And so there's a conquering of the ends of the earth, every part of the world, that we continue. 2 Corinthians 10 talks about how we're defeating and tearing down strongholds and waging war, not according to the flesh, but by bringing every thought captive to the Son. And we do that by bringing these words and these ideas that bring people captive voluntarily to the great King who will reign in righteousness. And so there's the sense of Jesus will have this forceful discipline that he brings into the world. And someday, if people won't bow down, they will be made to bow down. Everyone will know in the end, Philippians 2 talks about who Jesus is, and bow down to the king, kiss the king.
And then the kings then, who were initially talked about in the beginning of the psalm, they have a responsibility after knowing that this king, the Son of God, is going to reign. And in the last three verses of the psalm says, now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. So the warning there is that we need to fear God. That is the most important warning to take away from this. Know that the king, the son, is going to reign, and he is going to destroy, and he is going to punish, and therefore that should bring a certain level of fear. And that fear is not just a fear that causes us to become completely shut down. It's also a fear that should lead us to rejoice, which seems very paradoxical, I think, in our way of thinking, that he says, rejoice with trembling. You know, fear God, respect him, hold him in reverence, but also take great joy that he is the king, that he is in charge. And then it says to kiss the Son. That's the imagery there is just rich. I think it's that the Son is, in a sense, going to be a personable ruler, that he will be approachable, and that he is someone that we can draw near to and have a relationship with. Just a small picture, but we see that obviously in the life of Jesus. He was humble, he was kind, he was approachable, and the fact that we respect him, that we would kiss him. If we don't, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. And that seems to be kind of the opposite of the way that Jesus presented himself in his ministry often. We don't see him very often becoming angry and his anger or his wrath quickly kindled. But you do see pictures of that in his ministry as he was overturning the tables of the money changers in the temple, whipping them and just enacting justice there. You do see that not only was Jesus taking little children onto his lap, teaching people, getting down on his knees, as we talked about last week, washing each other's feet, but he was also one who enacted justice. So at the same time, he was both just and merciful. And so those are the two sides here being presented. If you want to experience the justice of God through his son, just keep living how you're living. Just keep scheming how you're scheming, and you should be afraid. But if you take great joy and refuge in him, as he talks about at the end, then you're going to experience his mercy.
How much better to kiss him, to adore, to worship, to love him.
Yeah. All right. So let's make a little bit of a transition here and talk about the challenge for this week. And we'll get into that in just a minute, but let's start off this conversation by talking about Bible study. What are some strategies? What are some things that we like to do? Let's just talk through that a little bit here before we talk about our challenge. I know you, Ryan, years ago, I want to even say decades ago, introduced me to a particular way of studying that has become a real tenet of the way that I like to think through the Bible. And that's a technique called the inductive Bible study.
Yeah, it sounds kind of technical, inductive, as opposed to deductive thinking. But the idea is just to start with the little pieces and back away slowly, putting them together to start to see the big picture. The basic idea is you start out by just looking at what it says, just observing what is happening in each little section of a passage. So you look at the verse and then you put those together into a paragraph and give that paragraph a title. And then as you get through the end of the chapter and you see all these paragraphs, these small chunks, and you have all these titles for these different paragraphs, and a lot of Bibles have either paragraphs marked out or sometimes the first verse will be bolded of a particular passage or group. And that's helpful. So you name these paragraphs and then you give a name to the chapter. It's not like anybody else ever needs to see this. This is for you to start to internalize what this chapter is. You're trying to get it into a form that you can really see it as a whole. And then you might look at, there were some words. I noticed that in this psalm, there was a word that was used three different times. I'm going to mark each of those or note each of those. And then you get this sense of this whole journey that Paul takes you on there about what love is. So that's the essence of it. And then you get to working through interpreting and applying it. But is there some part of inductive Bible study that you tend to always do or to grab onto and enjoy the most?
I think for me, the marking, identifying key words, key phrases, these kinds of things is something that I do a lot. And I feel like the more you see repetition throughout a particular chapter or section or whatever, you really start to get an understanding of what the intention is behind the writing. And so I love the highlighting piece of it. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I started out by, you know, obviously a deck of colored pencils and highlighting things in my Bible. And I found, at least for me over time, that I don't tend to stick with the same Bible for a very long period of time. You know, sometimes I'll change translations or I'll try to switch up my Bible, and I don't always have the Bible that I started marking in with me. And so one of the things that I've been doing is I use the Logo software, which we talked about an episode ago, and I love the software. It's fantastic. But one of the things that it provides is a facility to actually go and do the marking within the app itself. And I love that because then all of my markings are stored in there and I can take them with me on my phone, on my iPad. I can look at them on my computer and I can change translations and the markings follow. And all these things that you see, the benefits there of moving past doing it on paper. There is something, though, viscerally, I guess, that is nice about doing it on paper. Mm-hmm. But I do like the ability to do that in a more 21st century kind of way. But the marking of it is obviously really important. But I think the other piece for me that is equally as important, I think a lot of times we tend to dive right into verse by verse by verse interrogations of a particular section of scripture. But I like to start everything really by just reading it end to end, reading the book end to end, reading that particular chapter again. And as a way of beginning the study, that helps you prevent missing the forest for the trees, that you're not diving too much into too much detail right away, that you can kind of get a high level overview and then narrow down your focus into something much smaller. So,
yeah, the idea of reading the whole is so helpful. That I remember when I was 19 or so, one of my teachers, Steve Wolfgang, said one of the most helpful things you can do is read through the book that you're studying aloud 9, 10, 11 times. Just read it back to back. Keep coming back to reading it aloud over and over again. And it sounds like, well, that, you know, that sounds maybe like that will be a lot of rote activity, or maybe that wouldn't be super productive, but it is so productive because you're getting a sense of the flow of the book. Of course, these books were originally written to be read out loud. And as you read through the whole, you start to get a sense of how each part relates to itself. Mm-hmm. Since we're kind of journeying through the Psalms here, I'm trying to get a real sense of what each psalm is about. And I'm putting titles and other songs that tie in with it and just collecting notes on each psalm. And I'm trying not to go too far or too fast through the book so that I can really, like I said, internalize or have this sense of what the first 15 psalms are each about and what they're doing and how they interrelate with each other. And then I'll move on. And memorizing those chapter headings has been a practice that's been very helpful for me through my life. And I think because I've changed translations so many times, yeah, I have a sense I can sort of paraphrase all these verses, but I can't exactly quote them. What I'm constantly drawn to is I want to walk away from this study of the book of Mark or the book of Isaiah with a sense of how the whole book breaks down, what each chapter is about. I want to be able to jump right to the call of Isaiah or the different messianic pictures from memory, be able to get to it, but also to know what each piece is, what the main idea that each piece is trying to tell me. And inductive study is really helpful for that because you end up finding the chapter breakdowns, but also the bigger sections. You create an outline from the text itself, rather than looking to a commentary to get an outline, which is great, and that's fine. But you start out by seeing, by noticing the way that the book of Genesis, for instance, is broken down in these statements of the generations of, and you start to notice that phrase, and you realize the writer of Genesis has given us an outline. Every time he says the generations of, that's a new section, and so you start using the outline as it's given by the text. And that's really helpful.
Yeah, and even backing up just a little bit, the three most fundamental parts of inductive Bible study are observation being number one. So asking yourself what the text says, read it over and over and over again, like you mentioned, and try to figure out what is the writer actually say. And I think the benefit here is just letting the Bible speak for itself.
Yeah.
Not going to other commentaries, not going to other external resources right away. Just you need to understand. I need to understand exactly what this is saying. And then you can move on to the second piece, which is interpretation. So what does it actually mean? And I think a lot of the times we get into this, you know, I guess we talked about eisegesis before, but this this exegetical kind of idea that you need to be able to understand what it means in the context in which it was written. And then the third one is probably the most important one. And if you miss this, you missed it all, is the application. So how does the meaning of this text apply, first of all, to the lives of those for whom it was written, but then also how does it apply to me right now in my life? And so those three ideas, observation, interpretation, and application, are kind of the fundamentals of inductive Bible study. And whatever title you want to call this thing, whether it's inductive or some other kind of name, really those concepts are the most important things to take away. So if you can know what the text says, you can know what it means, and then you can know how it applies to the listeners, but also to yourself. That's the ultimate goal in studying in this way.
Well, probably my favorite verse about Bible study in the Bible is Ezra 7:10, and talks about what Ezra did. And it says, "For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord." And that word for study has to do with searching and investigating and looking closely, observing the law of the Lord and thinking about it and pulling the pieces apart and putting them together and making sure you really know the text of the law of the Lord. And then it says, and to do it and to teach his statutes and rules in Israel. So you're studying it, you're searching the word, you're looking at it closely, and then you have to understand it in order to be able to teach it. And that might just be talking to your kids or your best friend about it, or making a comment in Bible class, or it might be teaching it in some other way. But you need to understand what it is so that you can talk about it and so that you can know the will of the Lord. And then most importantly, so that you can do it. It's meant to be lived. And Ezra got that. Ezra got that you search the law of the Lord for two reasons, really. So you can tell people about it and so you can live it.
There's a lot of tools and things that people have created over the years to help do this or to help facilitate these kinds of things. I actually, long time ago, when we first started getting into inductive Bible study, I bought an inductive study Bible. And so it actually, in the beginning of each book, it has a little bit of a rundown of things that you should do, key words that you should note, maybe key phrases to keep an eye on. And then all of the chapter headings throughout that Bible are blank. And so your responsibility is to fill them out. And then going through at the end of the book, there'll be a section there where you can create a table of contents of all the different chapter headings that you had put together or of all the different concepts that you thought the book broke down into. And you know, those are helpful resources, and I enjoy those a lot. But again, as I said, having a Bible that's dedicated to that, sometimes I'm not taking that with me, and so the benefits of that might be lost a little bit.
For about 25 years, I think I had six different inductive international inductive study Bibles, because I'm just hard on Bibles and I beat them up, and like you say, then you lose your notes, which is not great. I actually have one of those of my dad's that's really cool. My dad passed away over a year ago. And so it's really neat to look at his notes in the margins, these wide margins, and have that inductive study Bible. So it's sort of a journal,
yeah,
these inductive study Bibles. But you also put together a spreadsheet that you shared with me for inductive study Bible. And that, talk about Bible geeks. And so we both have worked with this spreadsheet and done basically all of the steps using a spreadsheet. That's another way to do it.
Yeah. Whatever the mechanism, I guess, that you want to use, like you said, yeah, I built this spreadsheet, ultra nerdy, but I just wanted a place where I could go back later on and that I wasn't constrained necessarily to a small amount of space on a page. And I wanted something that I could take with me and that I always had reference to. So doing it that way was helpful. A while ago, I actually bought a whole series of the new inductive study books, and they actually have, we'll throw a link in the show notes to these books that break down each book of the Bible and give you some strategies, things to do with each book that might highlight certain words or ask certain questions. I mean, these are not tools that you need. Obviously, all you really need is the Bible, but as a way of getting started, it is also helpful to maybe have a guide into maybe some questions to ask or some words to keep an eye on or what to do every day. That's what I like about these books, is they actually give you day by day specific things to do every day, which is helpful, helpful if you're kind of getting started with it. So
right now our ladies have a ladies class here at the congregation where they're going through one of those books from Precept Ministries on an inductive study of 1st and 2nd Peter. So those can be useful for a group to study through also.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing that inductive study is not always focused on, but I think it is useful, is doing these kinds of studies with other people, because what you observe or how you interpret something may be different than how somebody else observes or how somebody else interprets. And so just being able to lean on each other's experience and the questions that they're asking and the things that they're observing from the text, I think that's also really helpful.
And it's fun to learn together. And that's, everybody knows it's important. If you're a Christian that's been a Christian for a while, you've heard sermons on the importance of Bible study, but that doesn't always get us in the book like we really need to be. What we need to learn to do, going back to Psalm 1, is to delight. And I have a friend who talking about baseball. She wasn't interested in baseball, and her husband loved baseball. And she didn't get it, and she didn't think, you know, why does anybody even care? But she was with him at a Mariners game one time, and they live in Seattle, and everybody stood for the singing of the national anthem, and she looked around at people with their hands on their hearts, and something clicked for her, and she didn't get interested in baseball, but as she says it, she got interested in getting interested. And she started to think, maybe there is something pretty neat about a national pastime that pulls us all together and that we can enjoy this together with all of its traditions. And if you're not really excited, and it's not evil or anything, not everybody is as geeked out and as excited as we are about Bible study. But if you're not really excited about getting in and doing the work of Bible study, maybe you can get interested in getting interested and just think about the possibility that you actually love Bible study. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the more you get into it, the more you get into it, the more you do it. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back to Levi, you may not be super into it right now, but when you do just commit yourself to the practice of study, it just starts to build on itself where eventually it's just
step.
Yeah, exactly. That first step of getting in and doing your first study, the first detailed study of some passage, it's just going to lead you on to more study, and it's going to make that easier to do as you go on from there. So find some time, get yourself in a quiet place, set a routine, start off with a prayer, and just get yourself into reading. And to marking up your Bibles or to creating a journal where you write down your questions. That's another big piece of this too, is just, you know, you're going to have a lot of questions as you go through. What does he mean when he says this? What is this a reference to? What is this particular thing talking about? And I always love just writing down those questions. And then as you come across the answers to them, you can refer back to your notes and be like, okay, well, that's the answer to this question, or that's how this applies. Then I didn't see that before. So I think writing down your questions, noting all the repeated words, writing in your own headings, and really just trying to find out what it means and how it applies. All right, so give us the challenge for this week.
All right, well, you just kind of said it. Here it is. Study a chapter of the Bible and apply one of the inductive principles to your study. Put something into place where you are taking some piece that appeals to you of what we said and just get into it.
Yep, grab your pencils. It's time to go. All right. Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you have any questions, you can find us on our website at BibleGeeks.fm. There's a link at the top of the page if you want to email us and send us any questions or let us know something you'd like to hear about on future episodes. You can find us on social media. We are /TheBibleGeeks across all your social media platforms. And until next week, everyone, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
See ya.